have been doing single asperity friction measurements. And Bob Ashurst actually was working with Roy Mabudian at Berkeley and now has joined the faculty at Auburn University. He puts on some of our monolayer coatings. So I'm sure all of you have heard of MEMS technology. The basic idea is to shrink down mechanical devices to get the performance to cost ratio up for physical and chemical sensors, things like that. This is an example. It's a inertial sensor. These are used in all the automobiles nowadays. Upon rapid deceleration, they trigger airbags. And the specs on these are actually getting pretty good. I was looking yesterday on the web at 100, you're getting sensitivities around 100 microgs per square root of hertz. So they may be of seismological interest as well. Now, visible light interacts well with these structures because they're micron scale. So we can do things like make a programmable diffraction grating. And then with this structure, we can generate an arbitrary spectrum. This is just another kind of cool actuator made by this technology. In particular, what I'm talking about is polysilicon surface micromachining. So these structures are made from a process that comes from the integrated circuit industry. We use polycrystalline silicon. It's deposited amorphously, but it's annealed at high temperature around 1100 degrees Celsius to relieve stresses. And we use it because we can make multiple levels of this and control the stress very well. Now, all of these structures that I show here have two major things in common. One is that they work very well. You can do millions and billions of cycles, and they're very reliable. Obviously, this has to be reliable to be put in automobiles. The other thing they have in common is that they're designed so that nothing is allowed to touch anything. And of course, that reduces our design space. We can make lots of things touch. Here's some examples of things that touch in various ways. We have gears. We have a pin and maze here, guides. Here are some hinges that enable a pop-up mirror, all kinds of things that we can make. And these do work, but their reliability is of concern. And in fact, that's kind of limited their progress as far as putting these kinds of things in the field. Now, there are a lot of things going on here, and a lot of new issues that have been introduced. These things may adhere. They may slide. They may there may be rubbing friction. They are going to wear. And they're also kinematically, they're somewhat kind of loosely constructed, and so they wobble, and there's actually impact forces also. So there's a lot of things going on here, and that's part of the issue, is that there's so much try to understand. What I decided to do was try to concentrate just on friction, and instead of having that be a detrimental feature, try to take advantage of it. And so what I did is I designed what we call now a nanotractor actuator. And it's a friction-based actuator that works on the basis of a, you know, the same thing as an inchworm. What we do to move this is we clamp the leading clamp, and then we pull down this plate here in the center, and that will draw the trailing clamp forward, only by about 40 nanometers. We can now clamp the trailing clamp and then relax the plate and the leading clamp, and that moves forward 40 nanometers, and we can do that over and over. And so we can get pretty large-scale motion out of this with also precision positioning capability. Now, this enables some things that other actuators don't have. This moves plus or minus 100 microns, which is pretty far for a MEMS actuator. Typical comb drives only move maybe 20 microns or so. Generates a millinewton, which compared to comb drives is also about a factor of 50 or so higher force. And of interest, of course, is that now we have to understand the friction better to see if we can understand this actuator well. So before I get into how we make the measurements, let me show you what it looks like. This is an SEM of it. This is the leading clamp area here. This is the trailing clamp. And this is the plate along this length here. And this is one of this is the spring. So it's actually four springs that work together. They're called a folded beam suspension. They keep it so that it moves on track. And also, in this case, it's a linear spring. And most of the talk will discuss having a linear spring. Now, how we make the clamp is important. So we're going to take a cross section through this plane here, YY, and look in this direction. And then what we'll see is in the center, we have this actuation plate. And then on the right side and the left side, we have part of the same clamp. We have to make two of these so that it's a stable device. And if we look at just one of these, the way we develop normal force is not by mass, it's electrostatically. So if we apply an electrostatic force, this comes into contact, or this is attracted towards this, and the actual frictional contact is made in this area here. So this is about a 2-micron wide area, and it's as long as the clamp is, usually a couple hundred microns long. And this enables us now to look, for example, at Amington's law over a wide force range, because we can apply a very large range of normal forces, from about a micronewton to quite many millinewtons. Now, the surfaces are rough, and these are, it depends what your definition of rough is, but these are around 2 to 10 nanometers or so surface roughness. And typical radius of curvature of the Asperides is around 20 to 500 nanometers, maybe typically 100 or 50 nanometers or so. Now, of course, that's a very nominal value, and all the discussion about fractal properties is important. But the main point I want to make is that a contact diameter of the individual Asperides, based on a number of around 100 nanometers, would not exceed about 10 nanometers or so. So the individual contacts are about 10 nanometer diameter, and they're subject to pretty high pressures. So even though our loads may seem low, the actual pressures that they're subjected to are pretty high. And of course, like any rough interface, the real area of contact is much less than the apparent area, and it will depend on load, of course. So this is just a little movie to show how it works. It'll come. It's actually, there we go. This is now the plate going up and down at 5 hertz or so. You don't see any motion yet because these are only 40 nanometer steps. This is 50 hertz. And this is 500 hertz. And so at that point, you see it moving along the surface quite well. We can actually run this up to about 50 kilohertz or so, so we can get several millimeters a second. We'd only see this in one frame if we filmed it at that velocity. Now, so far, all I've discussed is how this thing is built. I haven't said anything about how we measure friction with it. And it's going to come. You have to be patient. I've switched to the next slide. This is 500 microns from here to here. What we do is we apply monolayer lubricants to these surfaces. And, oh, I remember. Let's see. And the two lubricants I'm going to discuss today are fairly short-chain fluorocarbon. It's FOTIS, tridecafluoro octadecyl tris dimethyl aminosiline. And it's deposited by a vapor deposition process. What's important is that it's an 8-carbon chain. So it's fairly short, and the van der Waals forces are thought not to be strong enough for this to assemble in any kind of ordered way locally. So we think of it as kind of a tangled monolayer on the surface. Although it does raise the contact, this is still a fluorocarbon surface, so the surface energy is very low, and the contact angle is quite high, up around 110 degrees. The other monolayer that I'm going to look at is OTS. This one is probably more familiar. And this is octadecyl trichlorosilane. It's done in a liquid deposition process. The chain is 18 carbons long. And so it has, the van der Waals forces in this chain are likely strong enough that you get some at least local ordering with this kind of film. And so the contact angle is also about well over 100 degrees. So this film really looks, at least locally, somewhat like this here. It probably does not have long-range ordering. So to make a dynamic friction test, what we do is we walk out this nanotractor. And it's sitting between, a spring is fixed to a fixed point on the substrate, and it provides force to oscillate this in plane. And so what we're doing in this test here is, this is the 50 micron bar right here. And so it's out about 55 microns, which is represented right here. And this is just a 1D oscillator, so we can let go of this and watch it. And we get data like this, which is representative of a dissipative decay. So that can be modeled quite easily, even with an analytical approach. And the thing to remember is that if you have air damping, you have an exponential decay. And if you have friction damping, you have a linear decay. If you try to match this curve with only one of those two, you can't match the curve very well. If you use both, you get a very good fit. And then you can quantitatively extract what the damping is. And in fact, we get a Q of about 11.5, and that agrees quite well with simple linear damping Couette theory. The friction is also measured from this and is extracted. And in fact, this friction was measured with effectively zero load applied. 2 × 10⁻⁹ kilograms times G is pretty near zero load. Actually, it's a slightly tensile load because the springs that acts in plane also gives a slight out of plane force. So there's friction that we measure at negative load, which is due to adhesion, as you might expect. Now we can repeat this test where we do apply a small electrostatic force. We get the same kind of decay curve, but of course it happens faster because we're adding friction forces. And now we can plot the friction force versus the applied load. And so taking into account the gravity and this out of plane spring constant, we can get the slope. From the slope of the line, we get the dynamic friction value. And from the x-intercept, we can calculate what the adhesion is. The adhesion comes out to be around a nanonewton per micron squared. That's about a kilopascal or so. So here we had a coefficient of friction of about 0.24. We can also do a static test. In the static test, it's somewhat similar. We walk it out first. We apply a large normal load, and then we gradually reduce this load. And then at a certain point, we see a big slip event. So when we see that slip, we take this point here as a static friction point. Then we further reduce the load, we get another slip. And so we can repeat that over and over. This is here measured versus clamp voltage, and it's easy to convert that to clamp force. And so we draw a line to this kind of data here to get the static friction. And that's done here. So for the static friction, we get a value of about 0.33, which is slightly higher. This is all for the FOTAS monolayer. We also extract the adhesive force, and within error, it's the same as it was for the dynamic force. And that's kind of what you would expect. We think that this value of around a kilopascal or so is due to two contributions. One, of course, is the adhesion at the asperities that are in contact. But there's a second contribution which is likely very important, and that is that there are vast areas that are not contacting but within about 20 nanometers or so separation. And so if you do some calculations, there's actually enough attractive force from these vast non-contacting areas to contribute significantly to this adhesion force that we measure. Okay, so we can measure this static friction and dynamic friction for these two monolayer coatings, and we get, in a sense, very different kinds of values. In the case of FOTAS, the friction is 0.33 for static and 0.24 for dynamic. For OTS, what's interesting is it's lower, as you might expect, because the chain has better order, But the static and dynamic friction we measure is within error equal. Now we want to try to understand this at with AFM single asperity measurements and see if we can build up from a constitutive law at the single asperity scale. To make the AFM measurements, we have to coat the tip as well as the substrate. We actually do this at the same time that we coat the nanotractors in the same coating run. And it turns out that that makes a huge difference, about a factor. If you don't coat these tips, you get about a factor of 10 larger friction. So it's you really need to do that. We also do make TEMs. This is actually Rob and Aaron's work, of the tips to make sure that they're not double tips, which turns out happens quite frequently. When we look at the AFM data, at least we get some qualitative agreement between the FOTAS and OTS friction. It's hard to extrapolate at this point the shear strength here. And the reason is that the monolayer compliance is a significant contribution to the area of this contact. And we're still trying to work through the details of that. That said, looking at some of the previous data and comparing, these shear strengths are low. And I would estimate no more than 100 megapascal and probably significantly lower, maybe 50 or even 20 megapascal. And you might expect that because because we've coated both surfaces. Now, I'm going to just go through this very quickly. We wanted to see, and this is how we got into this issue of slip, do these coefficients of friction, the dynamic and static, predict the performance of this actuator in a test where it should depend on those, on their values? And to make a long story short, I'm not going to get into it, what we could kind of model some of our data, but it didn't make really any sense at all. We had to make some of the stiffness of our plate be much less than we thought it should be. And what we were able to infer from our data is that in these tests, when we load both the trailing and leading clamps but to different loads, we don't get the step size you might expect from just a coefficient of friction type of calculation. The leading clamp must be slipping forward even though there's much lower load on the trailing clamp in these tests. This got us interested in this issue of slip. Of course, this slip in those experiments is at the nanometer scale, so we have to measure that. What we're doing is we use a reference grating, and we compare its phase to the phase of a moving grating that's attached to our structure. So we can resolve the phase to about one part in 2500 or so, and this gives the pitch of this grating is 2.5 microns, so we have about a 1 nanometer in-plane slip resolution. So now let me remind you how we take the friction data. What we do is we walk this out to some position, we apply a large load on the clamp, and then we gradually lower that load. We don't yet have independent control of the tangential force. And so now with this 1 nanometer metrology, we can kind of see what's happening in this regime here. And in fact, what we see is that before this transition to dynamic friction, there's a lot of activity in this area, and it's maybe not surprising. One thing that was interesting about this data is that if we ramp down the normal force, for example, to this point here, and we just watch to see what happens, we don't see any subsequent motion. It seems to be stable. So we call these stable pre-sliding tangential deflections. On the other hand, when we do this with OTS, now the big difference is that the dynamic friction of OTS is almost the same as the static friction. So you don't get these well-defined slip events then, because when it wants to slip, well, the friction really hasn't changed at all. So it's very hard to resolve any jumps in the OTS data. So eventually what we decided to do was just define whether or not when we were lowering this normal load, whether or not whether or not we were still getting motion. If every time we lower the normal load and we're getting motion, which was defined something like 1 nanometer every 10 seconds or so, If it's moved that much, then we don't change the normal load at all. And what we saw was that even though we don't change the normal load, we get very significant slip. And here, before we were getting 100 nanometers or so, here we're talking several microns of slip. And so this seems much more like a creep process associated with the OTS. And so this is versus time, then we see that we're getting about 3 microns occurring over about 4 or 5 minutes or so. So we are thinking of maybe the very simplest way to model the data for the PSTD, which is the pre-sliding tangential deflections. And this is, to me, this is not reminiscent of dynamic event in which you're, in which you're transitioning from static to dynamic friction. We only get, we can resolve this slip, it's less than a nanometer at a, with load, as we're dropping load. And so we're doing the simplest possible thing, really, which is to take the two interfaces, which we can measure with AFM, and then we're just mating those in the computer. And we start up at this point here. There we go. A high normal load. And we then calculate, based on the line scans from the surface, what the apparent what the real contact area is. We multiply that by a shear strength value and calculate what the frictional strength is. And then we reduce the load, which in turn reduces the contact area and the frictional force. Eventually, the frictional force is surmounted. When it's surmounted, we kind of, in an ad hoc fashion, we move the clamp forward by just 1 nanometer. And then we check the tangential load. Of course, the tangential load reduces slightly. We now check if the at the new position, we calculate the contact area. And if that new position is stable, in which case the friction force will be still larger than the tangential load, then we'll just leave it in place and continue this. Otherwise, we may get a large jump. Well, if we go through this algorithm, it just seems in a kind of a stochastic way that in a lot of cases you get slip across the interface that's kind of on the order of what we measure. It's a very simple model. But it seems maybe to be a place to begin with this phenomenon. So I want to make, as much as my understanding goes, a bit of a comparison to the rate and state phenomenology. My understanding is that the characteristic slip lengths in this are on the order of the contact diameter, something around 1. What I think we're measuring for the PSTD is something like 10. For this is with FOTAS. Of course, we usually see that static friction is larger than dynamic friction. We certainly see that for FOTAS. We haven't made these measurements of static friction as a function of time. I think we know how to do that. We haven't done that yet. This may well fall in the rate and state phenomenology. On the other hand, here we have creep. This is like 300 or so times the contact diameter the slip is. So it's not clear to me that, and we have the static friction essentially equal to the dynamic friction. So it's not clear to me that this falls within rate and state, although I'm certainly open to it, and it's clearly a very good framework for analyzing friction. The other thing I should mention is that, you know, we really need to improve our test apparatus. What we're doing so far, this is fixed, so we can't really control the tangential load other than walking out against here and then lowering the normal load. What is now that we understand this actuator fairly well, it's fairly straightforward instead to think of it as a stepper motor that can be linked in series with a slider. And so we should be able to make have experiments that are analogous to the rate and state or the way most people do friction measurements. Okay, so just to summarize, I think MEMS may serve as a testbed for multi-asperity friction measurements. At low loads, the normal force is dominated by adhesion. We get some correlation from our AFM measurements to our microscale measurements. There's certainly a lot more work to do in this area here to see if we can model what's happening really on the rough surfaces. The PSTD, these slip events, can govern the operation of the nanotractor, and that's because the step size of the nanotractor is shorter than the slip events are. So it turns out that static and dynamic coefficient of friction have nothing to do with the operation of the nanotractor. This PSTD, I made an argument that it may be a stochastic effect. On the other hand, for this other monolayer, the OTS, it looks like the phenomenon changes from this stable type of deflection to this creep type of behavior. Thank you.
Questions?
So in the cases where you saw creep, do you have a sense of what happens at long times, whether it continues to flow logarithmically or is bounded or?
Well, the way we do define the measurement is we wait for the velocity to kind of reach something close to zero. And we haven't done those really long-term measurements yet. What we found out is that this metrology that we have is sensitive to focus. And the focus depends on the temperature of our system because our microscope is mounted by aluminum. So we need to upgrade our test system to have temperature control. So we are very interested in actually two things. You know, how does this creep behavior change over long periods of time? And is the FOTAS film sensitive to creep if we raise the temperature a little bit?
Yeah, my questions are application related because it's fascinating to see this put to practice. But you're describing using the friction to your advantage in order to actually move the tractor. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you're looking for something that has a higher friction, friction coefficient than a lower friction coefficient. Is that better for your situation?
Well, most MEMS applications would rather have zero friction and zero wear. But, I mean, the point is that we can't get rid of friction, so we might as well use it somehow. And here, this actuator, you get some performance features that you don't get from other actuators. And so this can perhaps be useful. We have it in some applications prototype type device. In prototype applications.
The second question relates to the potential effects of creep and on the long term. Are you able to monitor this over repeated events to see if, in fact, the friction coefficients are maintained time after time when you do these experiments?
Right. We haven't looked at that yet. What we have done is some wear studies. So we can drag the trailing clamp under an applied load. And we can do this back and forth, and then kind of do SEM type studies. And silicon is not the best tribological material, and you do see a lot of wear. So I would expect changes in all of these things as a function of load and number of cycles and that kind of thing. And very likely the monolayers don't stay on that long. I mean, they're chemically bound in some cases, but it would be nice to know how well they're staying on. That's a very important issue that we don't really know how to tackle yet.
Have you tried disassembling to see whether they're still there, or is that?
Well, I mean, the locations where they'd be gone, it would be at the tips of the asperities, and so.
That's right.
This is fascinating. Is this a reusable machine, or do you put it on a monolayer and do your experiment, and then it's?
No, we can do. I mean, even when we try to wear this out on purpose, it still takes on the order of a day or two, depending on the conditions. So we can run these millions of cycles. There are lots of applications, though, where they'd rather have hundreds of millions of cycles. So I'm not sure that the monolayers are the right answer in the long run. You'd rather probably have a hard coating.
Other questions?
When you model it, are you modeling it as effectively one-dimensional, or?
Yeah, it's kind of so we take a 1D line scan, and we turn that into at every point of contact, we make an effective Hertz contact there. So it's still kind of a quasi 1D, 2D type of model. But we wanted to do that just to see if it was worthwhile to do the 3D, because that's more computationally intensive.
Okay, well, I guess it's time for our coffee break, and we'll reconvene on schedule.